case is 07-441, in re application of Rashawn Blackwell.
Mr. Chief Justice, Met Police Court, my name is Rashawn Blackwell, and I'm here to discuss the 2005 bar exam and its disqualification. I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time to rebut Ms. Trafford's
clock there. Watch your time on the clock.
Okay. My name is Rashawn Blackwell, and in 2005, my bar exam was disqualified. It was disqualified on the grounds that I exceeded a time limitation by finishing one word after the call of time. It was disqualified by the exam board, and I was not given an opportunity to defend my actions. The exam board disqualified my exam without offering me a hearing, and they also denied me prior notice, and that was in violation of my Fourth Amendment right to equal due process, and my 14th Amendment right to equal protection. All other students and applicants get a chance to stand up and support or defend themselves in their actions, and that was not afforded to me. All other applicants, if you take a look at the 2003 exam board hearing, you'll see that all other applicants are also given respect and given privilege and not expected to stop writing exactly at the call of time. And I'm here today just to ask for that respect and that my exam be upheld. The hearing below by the Character and Fitness Board found only that I finished one word after the call of time, and that word was Thomas. And if you refer to Ms. Mingles, the clerk of this court's testimony in the 2003 hearing, in which I was reprimanded for filling in captions and dates and names in 2003, Ms. Mingle clearly states on the record, and that's at 271 tab 36, that the rules are strict, but at the same time, there's no bright line rule. And the rules are intended to apply to everybody equally, and that no applicant should get any unfair advantage over anyone else. She says that if an applicant can exceed time while another is forced to stop, another applicant can proceed, the public trust would be violated. You know, the intent of this exam is to make sure everything is done fairly, and each applicant has the equal opportunity to display or demonstrate his minimum competency.
Counsel, the infraction seems fairly minor, and what concerns us, I think, more than the infraction is that in the subsequent investigation, there was a report that indicated that you have an inability to deal with stress. Even though you knew you weren't supposed to write overtime because of the first bar exam, you felt compelled to do so. You even went through exercises to try not to do so. And I think the greater concern for us is the law is full of stress. There are deadlines, there are irate clients, there are tough legal issues. And if you can't control your actions in such a simple matter as stopping when the deadline hits, how are you able to deal with the practice of law and all its inherent stresses? So I think our picture is the bigger picture than just writing a word afterwards. Please address that issue. How are you going to deal with those issues, and what are you doing currently to deal with those issues?
Well, the facts in the hearing below demonstrate exactly how my problem with my own personal stresses and my psychology affect how I operate within the bounds of the law. This was not an excess outside of what the rules allow. The clerk of court, Marsha Mingle, your clerk of court has said that it is reasonable for somebody to finish a word after the call of time. And I think if we do look at the big picture, it is the 14th Amendment. I'm just looking for the equal protection, the equal opportunity to display my competency. And as long as the clerk of this court allows other individuals to finish.
Was there evidence that the clerk of the court allowed other applicants in the bar twice?
There's
in two different exams we're talking about here, actually.
Well,
you did this twice.
If this was
two
the
different
first,
exams,
if this was the first, second, third, or fourth time that I took the exam.
Well, you've alleged that the clerk of the court, who then was responsible for the bar exam, allowed others to continue writing after the time was called. There's no evidence of that, is there?
Yes, there is.
Where is
the,
that? In the record?
In this current record. Now, let's see. The underlying hearing before the Board of Bar Examiners, Beverly Brasket, which is an administrator here, says that she has slapped the tables of other applicants and caught them riding past time and has not taken any type of action against those individuals. And here in this record, you can see that when I wrote or finished the word after the call of time, I raised my hand and I called the attention of a proctor, and she, in fact, said that this was minor and it's inconsequential. And her name was Chris Wilhelm. Again, the statements of Ms. Mingle say that this exam is intended to apply fairly to everyone. I don't want any extra advantage over anybody taking that exam. But at the same time, if another student has the opportunity to finish a word, finish one single word, because it's very limited at the time, I should be entitled, pursuant to the 14th Amendment, to get that same respect and that same privilege. This is a matter of equal privilege and protection of my interest in assuring that my rights and my privileges are the same as those testing with me. And that would ensure and secure the trust of the public. If anybody else is able to write, even finish one word after the call of time, and I'm not allowed to do that, the trust of this public is not going to be secure, and it's not a fair exam, and it's not constitutional.
Let's go to the issue that Justice Stratton raised. I'm concerned about it also, as of course was the commission. Dr. Hustako, I guess, was your psychologist that you asked to give a report, says that this is not a quote, but if the applicant does not address them, meaning the issues that he identified, he is likely to have difficulty functioning both in life as an attorney. We have a responsibility as a court to set a floor for applicants to the bar and those who take the bar exam to be able to assure the public as well as we can that those who have been permitted to take the bar and pass the bar and become an attorney meet minimum standards. And when there's a psychologist who identifies the issues that he identified with you and then says you're going to have difficulty as an attorney, doesn't it seem reasonable that the commission would recommend that you take some time to work out these issues and then come back and try to take the bar in 2009, which is a recommendation? That's not that far away.
Well, his support for his finding is, and it's in his opinion, is that's assuming that the rules require disqualification as soon as you make one false move outside of the guidelines, and that's not the rule. And also, if you take a look at the Bell case, the symptoms that he's saying that I'm having, he has no specific disorder found. In the Bell case, there was a specific order found, and that was that student had post-traumatic stress symptoms syndrome. He's just saying that I have symptoms of anxiety. He's saying that I have symptoms of depression, and he said I have unusual thinking. I've gone through law school.
Confused thinking, I think.
Cognitive confusion, a derivative
we like,
of...
We like unusual thinking, but confused thinking is a little different than that.
A derivative of which is dyslexia, okay? Cognitive confusion should not cause somebody in and of itself to be discriminated against. If my conduct shows that what he is concerned about is actually occurring, then that's sufficient. But my conduct shows that his alleged condition, which is cognitive confusion or some type of excessive thinking, there's nowhere in the record that shows that it causes me to act outside of the laws and the parameters. And the objective standards that this court has applied are applied across the board to everyone. And that's, you know, your basic fundamental law school exam, your graduation from a certified accredited law school. Those things are things that I've accomplished. And if I did have what he thinks I may have, then there's nothing in the record that shows that it's caused me to act outside of what's the normal. The clerk of this court said it's normal and it's reasonable, and she wouldn't take any action against anybody. She even said that in her own words, as a matter of fact. She would not take any action against anyone for finishing a word after the call of time. And here I am on Front Street. I finished one word after the call of time, and I would hope that the words of the clerk of this court would be dependable.
Do I understand correctly that after your pen had been put down, another applicant saw you pick it up after you looked around and then wrote something and put it down again? Or have I got that confused?
That is, that was on an earlier portion. She said that she saw me look around, and after time was called, that I wrote something. But I never admitted to that, and that did not happen.
And then I thought that you had gone to Ms. Mangle and asked her not to report this.
No.
Is that in the record?
What happened, there was another student that was about 15 feet away, and she said that she looked at me, she saw me do what appeared to be write a number at the top of my exam, like a number or a date, which is an inconsequential act in itself, but I'd never admitted to doing that. That was earlier that day, and that's what caused.
But rather than, the question I'm trying to have you address is whether or not you had approached Ms. Mangle and asked her not to report this.
No, I approached Ms. Mangle and tried to have my action documented so that I know I could write down while it was still fresh in my head exactly what I did, and what I did was finish one word. And she says that if you finish one word, that you no action would be a consequence.
So you didn't ask her not to report it. You didn't. There wasn't any discussion like that.
Not that I could recall. I remember asking her about her statements in the earlier proceeding about fairness to all applicants, and how the law should apply to everybody equally.
Yes.
I remember asking her about that, but I don't recall, you know, asking her not to report it.
Thank you.
She has made statements in her in that 2003 testimony that says that she sits and as she conducts the exam, you know, there's a tendency for her to make note of somebody writing past the time, and she selectively could choose to report that person or bring action against that person. And as it is to appears to me, this is a selective enforcement of the rules, and I'm just trying to get.
Would you like to comment? I think that's the least significant of the issue to me. But would you like to comment on the fact that on your updating of your report that you file to take the second, the bar exam, successive bar exam, that you left out two or three, a couple of criminal charges and a civil suit?
I'm very thankful that you brought that up, because that is the most important reason why I'm here today. The board below found that I did not properly disclose three incidents, which the record and my application, if you take a look in black and white, clearly show that I forthrightly and timely notify the court of three different traffic violations. There were two that happened in October 2004. When I initially submitted my application, you could take a look at my 2005 application, pages 7 through 9. I have the actual tickets and I have the underlying facts all listed out. And that's when I submitted that initial application. At that time, I was in custody and in Aurora jail. I hadn't been given any types of citations or anything like that. And at that time is when that application was dispatched. When I got out, I did what the rules required me to do and asked the court whether or not and when I had to submit my to submit that update. And that's when I did it. On May 6, 2005, I sent in my update saying that I had in fact been arrested probably about like a month prior. And this was still 2.5 months before the 2005 exam. So when I sat to take the 2005 exam, I had initially done my two disclosures, and then I timely updated the court as far as the third one. And I think that was a material mistake that the panel relayed to the board in terms of that.
You've used your time, Mr. Blackwell. Ms. Trafford.
Good morning. May it please the court. First, I'd like to clarify, I think, one point that we may have gotten a little confused this morning with respect to the testimony that Ms. Mangle gave in particular. So the court is aware there's really been three separate hearings with respect to Mr. Blackwell. After the 2003 bar examination, when there was a report by multiple students that he had written after time, there was a hearing before the Board of Bar Examiners, and that was the hearing at which Ms. Mangle testified and made some of the comments that Mr. Blackwell was referring to this morning. After that 2003 Board of Bar Examiners hearing, there was also a separate character and fitness hearing relating to the 2003 bar examination. The conclusion of the character and fitness board at that time was that Mr. Blackwell's problem with having written after time was obviously an aberration that was not likely to happen again. And that brings us to the 2003 bar examination. And the real purpose we're here this morning is, of course, as we know, it did happen again with incident of writing after time in the 2005 bar examination. And that resulted in a referral to the Character and Fitness Board again. And that is the proceeding that's here before the court this morning. We're not really here to review the decision of the Board of Bar Examination with respect to the 2005 bar examination, but really the report and recommendation of the Character and Fitness Board. And as Justice Stratton mentioned, that really opens up a range of issues that are far more significant than simply the one instance of writing after time in 2005.
What evidence was presented to the Character and Fitness Board besides the one doctor's report? Because in his brief, the respondent argues that he's successfully completed law school, he's worked in a tax capacity, he's managed a job, he's managed life successfully, and that is at odds with this report. So was there anything evidentiary given other than just this report on its face?
Yes, there was, Your Honor. In addition to the report, of course, Dr. Hustek did testify at the hearing as well.
And that was a doctor picked by the respondent?
That was picked by the respondent. At the beginning of these proceedings, Mr. Blackwell, on the advice of his counsel, decided to retain an expert psychologist as a witness on his behalf, with the theory that that would help explain to the panel why this incident happened again of writing after time. So Dr. Hustet was selected by Mr. Blackwell and his counsel. He did author a written report, which is in the record as Exhibit J, and I would urge the court to read that report if you have doubts, because I think the psychologist does give some fairly chilling testimony in terms of some of the issues that affect Mr. Blackwell's ability to practice. But in specific answer to your question, the psychologist also did testify at the hearing, and I would urge the court to look at his testimony, particularly as it relates to where he's summarizing his opinions and then answering questions of the panel. Both Ms. Richards and Judge Tobin also examined the expert witness. And specifically, Judge Tobin walked him through each of the essential elements for essential requirements for the practice of law as promulgated by the board. And the testimony at the hearing, and it's at transcript pages 143 to 163, when Judge Tobin walked the expert through each of the elements, he testified that in his opinion, Mr. Blackwell was unable to meet 6 out of the 10 essential eligibility requirements. And the ones he was unable to meet based upon this witness's testimony went to the very heart of the very fundamental characteristics that are so important to the practice of law: the ability to think clearly, the ability to communicate clearly, the need to be diligent and reliable in your professional dealings, the ability to exercise good judgment, and also the ability to meet deadlines and time requirements. The expert's testimony was in his view that Mr. Blackwell did not have the characteristics that would meet those essential eligibility requirements.
Are you aware that Mr. Blackwell is taking any treatment currently, undergoing any professional evaluation or anything of that sort?
I have no knowledge since the time of the hearing. He was asked that question during the hearing because the expert's report was actually prepared in May of 2006, when the hearing was originally scheduled to be conducted in May of 2006. And so he was asked at the hearing in January of 2007 whether he had taken any steps on his own behalf to address some of the concerns raised by Dr. Husted in his report. And the answer in January of 2007 was no, nothing had been done during that period of time. I don't know what happened after 2007. But there was also other evidence presented at the hearing that I think illustrates some of the problems that the expert witness was identifying. And in particular, Chief Justice Moyer, you asked the questions about the failure to report. And there were two instances that really, I think, help illustrate some of these problems. One, there was a failure to report a collection action filed by the University of Denver. That action was first filed in August of 2003 and remained pending in the Colorado state court system until April of 2004. And that was an action brought by the University of Denver against Mr. Blackwell for failure to pay tuition. I think it was in the amount of $6,200. That civil action clearly needed to be reported the next time Mr. Blackwell filed his application to retake the bar examination. And it was not. And he was questioned at the hearing as to why he didn't report that, and we really didn't get a clear answer as to why that wasn't reported. It was either he had forgotten it, or perhaps he remembered it but didn't have all the details to report it. There was one other instance that also wasn't, I would say, promptly reported. And this goes to the March 22nd, 2005 traffic arrests out in Colorado. And I think the timing of this is important. And there is one, I agree with Mr. Blackwell, there is probably one inaccuracy in the board's report. Mr. Blackwell applied to take the bar examination again in October of 2004. That examination, that application was sent back by the Supreme Court because it was incomplete. So it was resubmitted in March of 2005. And Mr. Blackwell had included in that March 2005 submission two of the traffic offenses that occurred in October of 2004. But what he didn't disclose, and what I think I found particularly troubling, is he didn't report in March of 2005 that the day he instructed that application to be mailed to the Ohio Supreme Court, he was sitting in jail in Colorado, having been arrested, having received a summons and complaint for four additional traffic offenses in Colorado. To me, that was very troubling, because you have to picture the scenario. He's literally, his testimony was, he was sitting in jail in Colorado. He called back to his office and told a subordinate to send the application to the Supreme Court that very day, knowing that he was in jail with these four separate traffic offenses. Clearly, to send an application onto the Supreme Court and leaving that information out, I think, is a very significant evidence of very poor judgment on his part, at the least. It is true that he updated that application in May of 2005, after the charges against him were dismissed. But again, to delay that filing, to actually send something to the Supreme Court, knowing there was a material omission in that document, I think is a very significant offense, given the fact that there's very clear instructions that these kinds of traffic offenses, these kind of pending criminal matters, needed to be disclosed.
Ms. Trafford, what then is the remedy that you're seeking, or what is the relief that you're asking us to impose or consider?
We're, of course, asking the court to affirm the board's report and recommendation, and it is the board's recommendation that Mr. Blackwell's pending application be denied and that he be allowed to reapply in 2009, but only if he has evidence that he has addressed the psychological limitations that were pointed out by Dr. Hustick.
So
and
this
the,
case,
the board actually recommends he go back and see Dr. Hustick to get that level of comfort.
This case far transcends writing a word or two on an exam, well beyond, and it deals far more with some of the current application, or the application that was then pending, and some of these issues with respect to the practice of law that you're talking about.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And another thing we pointed out during the course of the hearing, I think you have to look at Mr. Blackwell's conduct during this proceeding itself, which is a fair inquiry to make. This proceeding with the Character and Fitness Board started in September of 2005. It took until January. Make sure I have that date right. It started in September of 2005. It took until January of 2006 for the panel to be able to pull the proceeding together to have the first scheduling conference. And that was in large part due to the fact that Mr. Blackwell needed more time to find a counsel and hadn't attended to that promptly. The hearing was first set for May of 2006. It was continued on the evening before the hearing was to start, because Mr. Blackwell had not promptly arranged to have his interview and his testing with Dr. Hustick. He knew in January that had to be produced to me and to the panel as early as April. It didn't get done until May, and it wasn't done, the report wasn't available in time for the hearing, so it had to be continued at the last moment. It was rescheduled for October of 2006. Again, it had to be continued at the 11th hour because Mr. Blackwell had excused his first counsel and was seeking to have new counsel come into the case and neglected to get the file materials to counsel, so she elected not to represent him in the second hearing, in the hearing that was scheduled for October of 2006. So it really wasn't until January of 2007 that we had this hearing, more than a year after the proceeding was commenced. That may seem like a small thing, but think of this. If this is the level of diligence and reliability Mr. Blackwell gives to his own legal affairs when his own personal interests are at stake, can we really comfortably entrust him to handle the legal affairs of other people?
Ms. Trafford, going back to Dr. Hustek, he reports that Mr. Blackwell took 4 hours to complete a test and left 20 answers, I guess, that were not completed. The MMPI-2 and the PF-16, I don't know what those are, but acronyms are great if you know what they stand for, but this doesn't really tell us what the test is. But Dr. Hustek apparently thought it was significant to indicate that it took him far longer, usually an hour and a half. People take an hour and a half to take the test, and took him 4 hours with 20 questions left unanswered. That, I would guess that's another issue with respect to his ability to practice law, to represent people. Is that, you haven't mentioned that, but it seems somewhat significant to me.
And that was very significant to Dr. Hustek, and he does testify about that fact in the hearing before the panel. And as he explained it, what was significant to him from that is it showed what he called the cognitive confusion. In the average, people are able to complete those tests in a relatively shorter period of time. But what he observed in Mr. Blackwell was that there is this cognitive confusion that affects his ability to concentrate and to get the tasks done. I believe Mr. Blackwell, in fairness, does testify as well that part of the reason for his failure to complete it timely was he didn't understand that it needed to be done in that period of time, and he had concerns about his sister traveling to visit him. Mm-hmm. But again, that ties directly back, I think, to the psychologist's testimony that there is this confusion in his thinking, in his ability to focus on the task at hand.
Counsel, was there ever evidence of the 400 clients that he stated he was involved with in tax preparation?
Mr. Blackwell did testify to that, and there was one of the character witnesses that he called to the hearing who testified by phone was a woman who had prepared, he had prepared her taxes for her.
But you did not have documentation of, let's say, W-2 or the 1040 to show the income or any of that?
No, we did not challenge that. And again, I think what's important is with respect to this inquiry that we stay focused on the essential eligibility requirements for the practice of law. No one is saying Mr. Blackwell is a bad person. No one is saying that he may not be able to function in a different profession. But the concern here is we have the character and fitness review for a very specific purpose, and that's the court's duty to protect the public and to make sure, as the gatekeeper to the profession, that people who are coming into the profession do meet this very rigorous standard for the requirements to practice law. So the fact that you may get through law school or the fact that you may be able to succeed in some different profession isn't really the question. The question is, based upon this record, does the court have the comfort that this person has carried the burden of showing, of demonstrating that he is going to be able to meet these essential eligibility requirements? And with respect, I think, with respect, particularly with Dr. Hustet's testimony, I think there's very serious cause for concern here.
Thank you, Ms. Trevor.
Thank you.
Mr. Blackwell, you use your time, but you may take 30 seconds to rebuttal if you wish.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just like to say that the essential eligibility requirements, you don't need a psychologist to come to that conclusion. In the Singh case, you know, there was an essential eligibility requirement, for instance, to whether or not the person could communicate. Well, they looked at the record and listened to what he's saying, and I'm asking that I be listened to. You take a look at the record and my activities then and there during the Ohio bar exam show the thing speaks for itself how I conduct myself under pressure. There's no more pressure than the Ohio bar exam. And I do have other professional statements that I was not able to have with me on that day because Dr. Hustek did not make available my medical records to the second professional for a second opinion.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion.